first case on our calendar, 04-1104, Gary Smith versus Simon Leach, Jr. Mr. Bergeron.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'd also like to reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
Thank you. Your Honor, the issue before the court is one of paramount importance for the administration of criminal justice within the state, and that is whether trial courts can impose mandatory cash-only bonds upon defendants. And, Your Honors, I think there's just a few points I'd like to make today. First, that Rule 46 absolutely proscribes this practice. Second, that the Constitution itself prohibits it. And finally, if I have time, I'd like to make the point that despite any mootness concerns, the court should still address the issue. And I'll start with the rule-based argument because I think it's the most straightforward. In fact, much to my surprise, the Attorney General actually supported me on this position. I think it's hard to overstate the significance of the Attorney General supporting a criminal defendant on a question of criminal procedure. And the reason they did so, to their credit, is simple. If you look at Rule 46A, when it talks about cash bond, it says, at the option of the defendant. Now, this is very significant in light of the prior version of Rule 46. Rule 46, as it was in place at the time this court handed down Hendon, had a phrase about cash bond, and it said, the court can require the deposit of cash or securities allowed by law in lieu of a bond. Your Honors, I think that is at least arguable that it would permit a cash-only bond, but this court in Hendon said no, it does not. And so when the rule was amended in 1998, I submit it was done so to clarify that Hendon retains its vitality by making it clear that it is at the option of the defendant rather than something that can be ordered by the court. The rule simply prohibits cash-only bond.
But didn't the rule amendment say that a judge could order an additional or different type of bond?
Well, Your Honor, it does say that the judge has the ability to determine the types or amounts of bond and conditions.
And that was the amendment to the rule following the constitutional change.
That's right.
So what does the term additional or different type mean in the context that you're presenting your argument to us?
Well, Your Honor, I think that where that actually shows up in the rule, and this was my next point, is in 46E, where it talks about amendments. And of course, that's the prosecutor's argument. Because there's this language in 46E, then cash-only bond is permissible because it seems to be broad language. But of course, my response is that only deals with amendments. There's no question here that Mr. Smith's bond was not amended. And so any amendment has to fall within the purview of 46A. I mean, 46A explains the different types of bonds that are permissible. And when it talks about cash, it says at the option of the defendant. Should not be read to create some limitless right to go beyond what's in the plain term of the rule.
But the judge has the authority to order a different type of bond in an amendment subsequent to the voters' change to the Constitution following our decision in Hendon.
Right, but the plain terms of the rule says there are three different types of bonds that can be imposed. The recognizance, the 10% bond, and then the surety bonds. And the cash was a component of that, but it made clear it was at the option of the defendant. What I'm saying is the rule as it stands does not permit that. I know, and I'll get to this in a minute on the constitutional side about whether that changes anything, but the rule as it stands does not permit that. And where that language shows up, Justice O'Donnell, in the amendment section, simply cannot create new rights in 46A that go beyond the plain terms there. And with respect to the constitutional prong, Your Honors, I do take the Attorney General's point that generally the court should avoid deciding difficult constitutional questions. But that's a prudential rule, and my response is, you've already decided it. You decided it in Hendon 10 years ago, and no one has suggested that the changes in Section 9, Article 1 of the Constitution were meant to have any impact on the Sufficient Sureties Clause. For 200 years, the Constitution has said all persons shall be bailable by sufficient sureties. The change in the Constitution was to broaden the class of people that could be denied bail outright. But there's no question that that procedure was not employed with respect to Mr. Smith. And again, getting back to your point earlier, it does say in there that the judge can, or the trial court can set the type, amount, or condition of bond. But that must be read against the backdrop of the opening clause of the provision. And that is the sufficient sureties language. And again, in Hendon, when the court was addressing this issue both on the rule and the Constitution, I'd like to point out that it never quoted the text of the rule, but it did quote the Constitution. And it made abundantly clear on numerous occasions that it was basing the result on the Constitution. It said the only apparent purpose of specifying cash-only bond is to restrict the accused's access to a surety and thus to detain the accused in violation of Section 9. And it also recognized that when a defendant exercises his constitutional right, to enlist a surety to post bail on his behalf, the clerk of courts must accept that. And Your Honor, I pointed out in my brief why the legislature that proposed the amendment to Article 1, Section 9, and the citizens that passed it must be presumed to have knowledge of this court's decision in Hendon, and there was no response to that. Obviously, when the language, all persons shall be bailable by sufficient sureties, was left alone, it must have the same meaning it had when the court construed it in Hendon. The Attorney General's argument is that, well, there is this phrase from Hendon that says it's silent as to the types of bond that are permissible. And that's true, it is. But you look at the rest of that paragraph, and it makes clear what the court says is once a judge chooses that condition, the condition of bond, and sets the amount of bond, we find no legitimate purpose in further specifying the form of bond which may be posted. The overriding concern, yes.
When I read this amendment to the Constitution, forget the rule for now, let's just look at the Constitution. It says, all persons shall be bailable by sufficient sureties, except for a person who's charged with a capital offense. That was the first one. That was
correct.
What it was originally, correct?
Correct.
And in that situation, a person could be held without bond, correct?
Correct.
Or cash bond.
If the proof was evident or the presumption great.
And they could be held with cash bond.
I'm sorry, no, I don't believe that's the case. They could be denied bond.
But it doesn't say, except for a person who's charged with capital, sufficient sureties doesn't modify the second part. It just says, except for a person charged with capital offense.
That's fair, Your Honor.
And then the amendment says, and except for a person charged with a felony, where it says, all persons shall be bailable by sufficient sureties except for capital offense, felony, and then it says where they're charged with that type of offense, they may determine at any time the type, amount, and conditions of bail. That seems to be a different type of bond requirement or allowance than the ordinary person that just has the type of crime that doesn't meet that category.
And Your Honor, I think when the Constitution goes on and says we want the General Assembly to prescribe terms in accordance with this, and that's what it did in the revised Rule 2937222, and it provided a specific procedure that must be followed in order to deny someone bail, because they recognize this is a very serious.
But if we find the statutes in conflict with what the Constitution allows, the Constitution doesn't seem to say that persons charged with a capital offense or felonies that fit in this second category still have to be sufficient surety. It doesn't say that. It says they can have any type, amount, or condition.
But there has to be a threshold showing that they fall within that. And that's
I agree with that. But once they fall within that, this constitutional amendment doesn't put a surety requirement on it.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that they have to be shown to have fallen within that, within the rubric of the statutory framework. And when that was never invoked in Mr. Smith's case, so he is still entitled, whatever the effect of this subsequent language, he is still entitled to the sufficient sureties clause.
You're saying he does not fit into the category of felony where the presumption is great?
Well, Your Honor, he was obviously charged with a felony.
And what type of felony?
I believe it was initially murder and assault.
That wouldn't be a category that fits that. I mean, that's a pretty serious category.
I agree, Your Honor.
I mean, why wouldn't he fit that category of substantial risk of serious physical harm? He's already charged with murder.
And again, that is because you're talking about what he's charged with, and what I'm saying is, but that's not the end of the analysis. You still have to show that there's a likelihood that he's going to be convicted of this and that he's a risk of harm or whatever other factors, and that's what's implemented in the statute, and that's what was never invoked for Mr. Smith. And in this case, his conviction had just been overturned, and obviously, if the state wanted to make that showing, they could have had an opportunity to, but they did not. And because they did not, he is entitled to the sufficient sureties clause as it stands in the Constitution.
So you're arguing more of a failure of procedure.
Well, I mean,
you can interpret the statute as I suggested and still win arguing they failed to follow the procedure, right?
That's right. That's right. Your Honor, I would just like to make a brief point about mootness in my remaining time. As the Attorney General recognized, this case is one of importance throughout the state, and they urged the court to resolve it. I agree with that, despite the fact that Mr. Smith has now been resentenced after his retrial. And as an illustration of that, there's the other decision from Hamilton County that I just happened to notice while reading the paper while I was preparing the response brief, where another defendant was sentenced to cash-only bond. Certainly haven't done any empirical studies here, but it looks like this is an issue that is a recurring one within the state and should warrant this court attention.
So, counsel, if we accept what you're saying, judges would be would not be using cash bonds, but instead, in situations like this, there would be a hearing held to see if the individual should not be bailed at all. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, if it's a serious enough offense, and if they have enough evidence, and if the state wishes to deny them bond, that's the procedure to go through. But if otherwise, the bond could be set, he could be allowed access to sureties. That's no guarantee that he'll actually be able to post the bond. That's, of course, analyzed under the excessiveness inquiry. But the state may say, look, we don't need to go through this because the bond will be what it is. We don't know if he'll be able to meet that or not, and we're not too worried about it. But if it is someone that they are very concerned about, they have these procedures at their disposal.
But this would be taking an option off the table for the judges as they are currently using.
It would, Your Honor, but what I would say is that in Hendon, that was even more dramatic because you didn't have this other procedure, and now you do.
Well, counsel, isn't it the reality that if you prevail, that a judge who is concern, but doesn't think this rises or doesn't want to fool around with the hearing on whether or not bail should be denied, they'll just say bond is X, and that number will be a substantially larger number than it would have been before this case was decided in your favor, and let's say, and that can be cash or surety, and the real effect will be 10% of the new number will still keep that defendant probably locked up.
Well, that's a possibility, Your Honor, but I think
that's not what they're supposed to do, but that's in reality.
That's right.
What may happen?
That's a possibility, but what I would suggest is they've still got to be within the confines of the excessiveness clause. And if they're just going around setting, you know, $1 million bail for anyone who, you know, stole a car, I don't think it's going to hold up. And
well, I'm not suggesting that, but in your case, it's a little more serious offense.
Agreed. But even in the Brooks decision from Minnesota, that was $6,000 cash bond, and the court said that violates the Constitution. But again, just give them a chance to meet that with a surety. That's what we're asking for. I'd like to reserve my last few seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Bergeron. Ms. Lapp.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counselor. The issue here to be briefed was, is a cash-only bond authorized? The state's contention is, to answer this, you need only look at the Constitution as it stands today. In 1998, there were two major changes made to the Constitution, both of which broadened the powers of a trial court to set bond. The first, which has been briefed, has to do with the right to deny bail entirely to a felony offender when the state makes the showing that there's a substantial risk of serious physical harm. But for the state's argument, the next sentence is the most important. They added the specific language, where a person is charged with any offense for which the person may be incarcerated, the court may determine at any time the type, amount, and condition of bail. This can be harmonized with the Criminal Rule 46. What's important, very important in the Constitution is the next paragraph down with the enabling language. The first sentence has to do with setting up, telling the General Assembly that you can set, they need to set the standards for the hearing on the violent offender. But the next sentence, procedures for establishing the amount and conditions of bail shall be established pursuant to Article 4, Section 5, which is the rules section. Now, it's very conspicuous. That sentence did not say to us for the rules to establish the procedures for establishing type. It left out the word type. The first part of the Constitution says the trial court may establish the type.
Well, counsel, what's the point of setting up a new detailed procedure for having a hearing to deny bail if, in fact, all the judge has to do is say it's cash only, and effectively deny bail for all but the wealthiest in our society?
Because the voters decided they wanted this issue addressed of violent offenders, and there is a procedure for a hearing. If you deny bail completely, that takes is much more of a restriction on a defendant. If you set a high cash-only bond, there is still the possibility that you could find a surety who would put up the cash. It's two separate vehicles. They are very different. And it's my contention the Constitution, by adding the language giving the state, giving the trial court the power to set the type, did not then take it away by, say, the phrase at the option of the defendant. By setting up the procedure for this hearing, it did not take away the significance of the sentence that was added to the Constitution. Otherwise, there would be no meaning to that sentence having been added. And there would be no meaning to the sentence being added saying the trial court can set the type, amount, and condition, but then under the rule saying only set a rule having to do with the amount and condition. The phrase at the option of the defendant in the Rule 46 was added after 1998 with this amendment to the Constitution. How this should be interpreted is it's a limiting phrase. If a judge is ambiguous as to the type, then it could be up to the defendant to pick which it would be at his option, whether he'd like a surety, assured by securities, by property, or by cash. But that phrase alone does not trump the constitutional language that was added in 1998, giving the trial courts the power to set the bond.
How do you get around the Hendon case?
When the Hendon case was written, the Constitution did not have any of the language in here that specifically said the trial court may determine the type, amount, and condition. And this is not to get around, but there is a little perspective on, with the time the Hendon case was written, there was a procedure going on in Hamilton County where bondsmen were able to get a license without having any proof that they had the financial securities or wherewithal to be a bondsman. You could put up $1,000 and get a license. And then you did not have to show that if a defendant that you wrote a bond on didn't show up, you didn't have to make any showing that you could come up with that money. And so what was happening was a lot of bondsmen did not have the money. And, I mean, this is a sidelight, but they were, it was becoming kind of a vigilante system where the bondsmen were going out making their own arrests and bringing people in. That's just the perspective on how that issue came. But at that time, the Constitution said all persons shall be bailable by sufficient sureties, excessive bail, you know, shall be reviewed. But it didn't have any of the language saying the trial court may determine the type, condition, and amount. No specific language. And since then, that language has been added and is very significant. And I think that does give the trial courts the power to set a cash-only bond. The other thing that I would just want to bring out, and I put it briefly, there are other states, almost the majority of the states have the language in their constitutions, all persons shall be bailable by sufficient sureties. And there's an in-depth discussion in the Briggs case where the Iowa Constitution has that. We also have Alabama, is following it. There are several cases that have gone into this. The word sufficient has a specific meaning. The Constitution doesn't say all persons shall be bailable by sureties. It could have said that, but it doesn't. It put the word sufficient in there, which does show it is not a completely unfettered right of a defendant. And the fact that...
That language has not changed with the 1997 amendment, was it, 1998 amendment?
No,
of our Constitution. So why don't we have to read, why then do we not have to read the type, amount, and conditions of the amendment in context with the guarantee that one can post a surety?
I think a court is allowed to ensure there are sufficient sureties. It's not an absolute right.
Okay, sufficient sureties. Here, the argument is that no surety was offered. Cash only means no surety, doesn't it?
I would argue cash is a type of surety, and in some cases, the only sufficient surety is cash only.
I thought surety here was a technical term, not a general term.
Surety has a number of meanings. It's been discussed in these types of cases. It can mean a person, or it can be a surety is a form of assuring a specific act. At the time the constitutions were written, in most of the states, commercial bonding didn't even exist. And surety referred to monetary, property, other means of assuring your appearance.
Is that a new argument?
No, Your Honor. That's in the State v. Briggs. It's in a number of the cases. State v. Briggs was 2003.
Okay. Counsel, I'm trying to think through the purpose of making it cash only. What would be the purpose of making it cash only?
There are cases. I'm hesitant to try to give a lot of hypotheticals.
Well, what's the judge generally trying to achieve when the judge says, and that'll be cash only?
Assuring the appearance of the person. There are many cases now where you have large amounts of money.
So I would be wrong if it seemed to me what the judge was really trying to achieve is assuring that the defendant didn't get out of jail.
Can I give you an example of a nonviolent case where we couldn't hold the hearing, but a large amount of cash would be the only way to secure appearance? There are, it's becoming more and more common. There was a large identity theft ring of persons who were not from the United States, who were operating out of Westchester, a small suburb in Cincinnati. And they had amassed huge amounts of money. A cash only, even up to $1 million, was not insignificant to them. I mean, it was something that could be made. In that situation, the only sufficient surety in a case like that would be cash. Each case is so different. That's why I do hesitate to try to sit here and say to you, well, with this defendant and this fact, there's so many factors that go into when a person, what is going to assure their appearance.
But if if cash, $1 million of cash is insignificant to them, aren't they, you're saying they're a flight risk, where if they had a surety, presumably the surety is going to invest a substantial effort in securing their reappearance. If they post $1 million and just skip, county's going to just say we're $1 million better off and probably not invest much in trying to secure their appearance.
Well, this is where I don't think I can second guess. I could speculate of all kinds of situations here, but I think the Constitution allows a cash-only bond.
Looking at it from the other end, let's say municipal court, as a matter of convenience, I mean, we're talking about the high cash bonds, but there are courts that, for example, will say 500 cash only. Is that correct?
Yes.
So it's not just the matter that you're talking about high cash bonds.
Yes. And I know in many situations, a cash only bond like that is actually easier for a defendant to make than a surety because they often are paying an additional fee to the surety. And in some situations, that's going to benefit the defendant.
Your argument that cash and surety are coextensive, though, is belied by 46A3, which distinguishes the surety bond, the bond secured by real estate or securities as allowed by law, or the deposit of cash at the option of the defendant. There are three separate categories there in that particular section.
And my contention is, a trial court may determine the type according to the Constitution. If the trial court doesn't or is ambiguous, can purposely leave it to the defendant, or if they're ambiguous, then that is at the option of the defendant. But that the Constitution, as it reads now, does give the authority to the trial court. My only point on the 46E amendment was this language, if you amend a bond, harmonizes with what is said in the Constitution, that at any time a judge may order additional or different types, that this did not in any way limit what the constitutional language was. And that's why I think that the Constitution as it stands, it can be harmonized with Criminal Rule 46. If you read the phrase at the option of the defendant the way I've described it as a limiting, I don't think there's any conflict, and I think it can stand as it is. But I think that the Constitution itself, that language, with that phrase, the sentence added, that a judge may determine the type, amount, and condition of bail, gives the trial courts the right to impose cash-only bonds.
So, counsel, to reiterate, your option of the defendant only explanation of that language is if the judge is silent as to the means but articulates an amount, then the defendant can figure out how he or she will make that amount. Is that correct?
If the judge either consciously determines not to set the type, yes, or if a judge is ambiguous. The way these things are done fast, and at times a judge does not specify. On those two occasions.
Your argument about ambiguity doesn't appear anywhere within the rule. The rule starts out by saying any person who's entitled to release shall be released upon one or more of the following types of bail. And three, the language that we've been talking about is one of the types of bail.
But the Constitution gives the right to the trial court to determine it, and the Constitution is going to prevail over the rule. See the caution lights. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lapp. Mr. Bergeron, you saved a little of your time. Take 30 seconds.
Okay. You know, on the ambiguity point, let's look at what the trial court said here. This is a quote. He said, "So what I'm going to do, sir, is set the bond at $1 million straight. No 10%, no property bond. That's $1 million cash only." There's no ambiguity here. There is absolutely no ambiguity here. And with respect to the Briggs argument that my opposing counsel is raising, Iowa is in the decided minority of cases of states on this point. Ohio is in the majority. And Briggs doesn't say cash-only bond is fine under the sufficient sureties clause. It says that's okay so long as the accused is permitted access to a surety in some form. So they want to make clear that you have protection under the securities clause, even under that minority approach.
Counsel, what's your response to the categorization by opposing counsel of cash being under the umbrella term of a surety?
Well, as was pointed out, I think that is somewhat of a new argument. I mean, that was not briefed at all. And I think it's simply incorrect. The purpose of the sufficient sureties clause is to give someone a chance to go to a third party and say, post this bond on my behalf. That's what sufficient sureties is. I'm not aware of an interpretation that says sureties equates with cash, and therefore that's okay.
Or that cash is one type of a surety.
Right. I'm simply not aware of any cases that have interpreted it that way. And I think, again, look at the text of the rule here. It says, at the option of the defendant. So even if that were the case, it would still be the defendant's option on the cash.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Bergeron. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.